We live in a very consumer-driven, focused, if you will, society. Advertising is everywhere, and everything's kind of focused in on consumers. And so a lot of people do approach religion in a consumeristic sort of fashion. They come to one place, may say, I don't really like this or that, or I don't like the way this is done this way or that. So they find another place that satisfies them. I think ultimately as Christians what we need to understand is that mentality is not the best mentality. It's certainly not what Jesus went around trying to do, and the apostles didn't try to do, is convince people of the consumer aspects of what they had to offer, that it was really nice package that was being delivered to them. But there is some degree of idea about being satisfied with God. And when I say that, it has to do with being content to follow His commands. The opening psalm, Psalm 1, verses 1 and 2 specifically, there we read, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of the sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight, and that's it, his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. Are we satisfied with God? Now, it's not my idea in saying this that, or asking that question, that it's like if we're not satisfied, there's some other God to go to, because there isn't. There is one God who created everything, and it's not our way that should be as mindful in the way we're thinking. It's God's way. Are we satisfied with Him, though? Ultimately, what this comes down to is keeping His commands because we love Him. So, in Philippians 2, in verse 14 and 15, we're told that we're to do all things without complaining and arguing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without defect, in the middle of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you are seen as lights in the world. Now, we kind of read this, and we understand we're not to complain, and yet complaining is just what we do. I mean, it's probably something that we've all done today already just because. It's just part of who we are. But it's not just modern man that does this. We can see throughout the Bible the complaining that was done. But the attitude is really what's attached to it. It's not on one side of this thing where, let's say you go to a restaurant and your steak that you've ordered as, I would probably order like medium. I figure they might get it right that way. I like a little bit more red in mine than not. But let's say it comes back and it's charcoal briquette. And I say, look, I can't eat this. And some would say, well, you can't complain. I mean, Jesus says you can't complain. So I don't think that's what we're talking about. You could send it back and say, look, this is inedible. I can't do this. I don't want to eat that. You know, whatever. Doing things without complaining and arguing has to do with the mentality of I can't be satisfied. I can't be happy. I won't be happy. The word complaining here is actually what we call, this is a hard word to say, I can't say it. Never mind. Onomatopoetic. Something like that. I forget how it's said. I'm sure some of you are like, oh, that's easy. It's like saying statistics, right? The Greek word sounds like the word complain. And the idea is it's a grumbling. That's really what it sounds like. It doesn't sound really like our English word complain. It's gongra, you know, and it's more of a sound than it is a word. Well, let's look for a moment through a few New Testament passages that use the word and kind of get an example from God's view of what this means. I know we know what complaining is, but the examples that he provides are pretty interesting here. Like in Matthew chapter 20, in verses 1 through 16. Verse 11 is where we find that word specifically. But this is a parable that we've read somewhat recently, talking about laborers in the vineyard. And the idea is that there is this master of a house. He goes out, verse 1, early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. And so he agrees with laborers for a denarius, which is typical for a day's wage. And they go work in his vineyard. But as the day goes, he keeps going back to the market area and finding men to work. And so by the end of the day, he does the same sort of thing. And he pays them exactly the same thing that he offered the guys who've been working all day long. The problem is, as you see in verse 11, receiving it, that is receiving what they agreed to work for, they grumbled. Well, that's the word complain. I mean, they didn't like this. It wasn't a shiny coin. You know, something that you'd send back, I want a shiny coin. This is grumbling because they got equal pay, and they worked a whole lot longer. Well, and that's what he says in verse 13. He replies to them, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Well, then take what belongs to you and go." And so, verse 16, Jesus' conclusion is the last will be first and the first will be last. The main point I'm wanting to make is, again, looking at their grumbling. Why? Because they got what they had agreed to work for. 1 Peter 4:9, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. And again, the Greek word is a sound more than anything. And it has to do with, you kind of mumble under, you murmur. That would be probably a good idea. 1 Corinthians 10:9-10. And we're going to read where this is connected in the book of Numbers here in just a moment. But here, Paul says, we must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, talking about in the Old Testament, and they were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, I think what he's talking about, if you go back to the book of Numbers in chapter 16, we'll read the last paragraph, basically, of number 16, and see what's going on. Number 16 is actually one of the most exciting chapters in Numbers, in my opinion, because a lot's going on. Korah has his rebellion where the earth opens its mouth, basically, and consumes Korah and everybody involved with his rebellion. Korah's the guy who basically says, are Moses and Aaron really our leaders? I mean, come on. Look where they put us. They put us out in the middle of nowhere, and really, we're out here dying. Don't you remember the cucumbers and the melons and the garlic, all the good things we ate when we were enslaved in Egypt? Really, that's kind of how they express it. We were slaves, but at least we had good food. Now they're in the wilderness, and what do they have? Well, they have manna, which is a Hebrew word meaning, what is this? You know, can you imagine? Oh, what's for dinner? We're going to have more of that, what is this? And that's what they have for 40 years. Well, number 16, as I say, verse 41, and then we're going to go through to the end of the chapter here. On the next day, after all this has happened with Korah, on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses. Again, more of a noise and a sound, but it's an attitude, is it not? It's not just this idea of, yeah, I don't really like blue, I like green. This is complaining where you are assigning the worst motive to the person who's done what they've done. On the next day, all the congregation of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and they said, you've killed the people of the Lord. Well, Moses and Aaron really didn't do anything anyway. I mean, Moses did say, as the people all got out to see who God was going to work for or work through, you know, if the ground opens up right now, and it does. So they blame Moses, I guess. I don't know about you. If I really believe Moses had the power to say, open up to the ground, and the ground opened up and killed all those people, I don't think I would test Moses at all. I don't think I'd mess with him. I don't think I'd be on the next day grumbling against him and saying, you killed the people of the Lord, and him go, open up, you know, and the ground open up. Well, verse 42 says the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron. So they're not just there, they're against them. And they turn toward the tent of meeting. Well, why'd they turn to the tent? Well, we're told, behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. In other words, something happened to get everybody's attention. And Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses and said, I want you to get away from the midst of the congregation that I may kill them all. I know the ESV puts it in a nicer way, that I may consume them in a moment. That means that I may kill them all. And they fell on their faces. Moses and Aaron didn't go, what? They fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, take your censer. I mean, I almost imagine they're next to each other, brothers. And he says, you put fire in it. And it's like he's talking fast. Put fire in it. From the altar, not just fire of any kind, but fire from the altar, which means Aaron's got to get up, go inside, right? Unless it's the altar on the outside, which very well might be. I didn't study which altar it could be. I, now thinking of this out loud, I'm thinking it's probably the altar on the outside of the tabernacle. Lay incense on it, carry it quickly to the congregation, make atonement for them. The wrath has gone out from the Lord, the plague has begun. Now, I don't know how much time it would take for Aaron to do what he was just instructed by Moses. It's almost like Moses just says, look, this is what you need to do. But I think Moses is the smarter of these two guys and says, I know what's getting ready to happen, and it happens. If you notice with me, as it goes in verse 47, that Aaron took it as Moses said and ran into the midst of the assembly, and behold, the plague had already begun among the people, and we're not even told what the plague was, just that it killed everybody. He put on the incense, and he made atonement for the people, and he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped right there at Aaron. Now, those who died in the plague were 14,700 besides those who died in the affair of Korah. So the writer here, Moses, is saying, look, in a moment, basically, God killed 14,700 people with a plague. And, I mean, it's amazing how many people had congregated anyway. But at the same time, how quickly God started killing them. And Aaron returned to Moses, verse 48 says, at the entrance of the tent when the plague stopped. Now, we're not told anything more than that, but the Aaron has to stand between the living and the dead. It's at him that the whole thing stops. Why? Because the people complained. And that's what Paul is saying. We don't want to be that way. We want to learn from them. Don't put Christ to the test, as some of them did, were destroyed by serpents, a different story. And don't grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, the term Paul uses, kind of a long way of getting to it, but the term he uses, if you look in the Greek translation of the Hebrew, what's called the Septuagint, it's the angel of death, basically. I know recently, I think Wednesday night, I've been kind of studying this a little bit here and there. Bottom line is, it's as if the angel of death came out and met Aaron right there, stopped at Aaron. So Aaron served as a go-between the dead in front of him and the living behind him, you know. I'm not saying that's exactly how it happened, but that's the way it comes across. I'm reading the story, especially what you read in Numbers 16, thinking, I don't think God wants us grumbling, right? Things happen in life we don't like, so what do? Do we turn against God, which is what these people did in turning against Moses and Aaron? They didn't like what they had done and the way they had done it, so they turned on them. That's kind of the point. They grumbled against them. Well, there's the idea of arguing. And these aren't, I know the thing is, these are not the only examples we could come up with. You might recall real quick that when the people complained that they had only manna to eat, what is this, which is the name they gave it, God didn't go, I'm sending you something I'm calling manna, which means, what is this? They named it that, which, can you imagine having that kind of an attitude toward it? I mean, they didn't know what it was, but they could have called it bread from heaven. They didn't. They called it manna, again meaning, what is this? Well, arguing has to do with disputing. This kind of almost sounds like Job. You know, Job is the one who seems to dispute with God, but he never assigns to God the worst motive. And the word that is used here, you can see that, dialogismos, okay? Great, now we have that. But it is where we get our word dialogue. You can almost see as those words, I mean, the first few letters are exactly the same. Dialogue. Now, this doesn't mean, because when we say we need to have an open dialogue, that we're sinning by having a dialogue, by talking, by discussing. It's what's going on in the person's mind, really, the arguing. And that's the problem. Matthew 15, 19, this is how it's translated. Out of the heart come evil thoughts. It's not the word evil, it's the word thoughts. Arguing is disputing from within. Luke 24, 38, Jesus said to them, why are you troubled? By the way, this is the context in which Jesus has been raised from the dead. It's already happened. He's talking to the apostles. Thomas isn't there yet. Why do doubts arise in your hearts? They are disputing. What's going on? Well, it's outside of their experience for sure, but that's not the point. In another passage, Luke 9, 46 through 48, we read that an argument arose among them, that is, among the apostles, as to which of them was the greatest. I wonder how that started. We're all sitting there going, you know, I wonder who's the most important here. I mean, how do you start that discussion and not go sideways pretty quick? Jesus, knowing, and here's the word, the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, whoever receives this child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you, he's the one who is great. And you know they probably just blinked at him like, what in the world does that all mean? Romans 14, 1, it's translated opinions. As for the one that is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. It's that same word, thoughts, dialogue. And I think part of it is the question that we might have, is God's way really better? I mean, is this the way to do it? So, like in Isaiah 55 in verses 8 through 11, Isaiah tells us that God speaks and says, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord." I mean, here's the thing. When Jesus comes to the earth, he comes from a family I don't think anybody else would have chosen. It's not just that they're not wealthy. They're kind of an inconsequential family. There's nothing about them that seems to carry the burden of consequence, you know? Not like an expectation of Joseph and Mary, but certainly that's how God did it. This whole thing of this Jesus who becomes Savior of all the world, you know, what Ron had just read to us from Isaiah 53, it's always been kind of an idea running in my own mind when the prophet makes the point there was no form of comeliness. There's no majesty about him. I've often wondered, was Jesus handsome? Was Jesus ugly? I mean, what was it? And I know the Bible doesn't go into that for good reason, because then we would, you know, try to underscore that quality, whatever that quality is. But the prophet says there was really nothing about him that attracted us to him. Well, that's the attitude that people have, and God says, my ways are better than yours. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there, but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty. It will accomplish that which I purpose and shall succeed in the thing for which I sent. Now, I'm kind of overemphasizing the word purpose and succeed here. The word purpose, just on a whim, I thought I'd do a little word study on purpose. It shows up in the book of Isaiah more than any book in the entire Bible. It's like more than a dozen times the word purpose is found. And you can see all these references. There's no reason to, you know, go through it unless you want to, but it's surprising to me, that word purpose. Because God has a purpose, but his purpose seems a little paradoxical. I mean, how would you think you would want to make Job a better person? Well, take everything away from him? Well, that's exactly what God does, and God does it in a way that shows his purpose, because his thoughts and his ways are higher than ours. Do we question God? Now, this is something I think we need to think about a little bit longer. It's not just the idea that God does things and we sit back and we question him. It's when the questions become, we won't allow an answer. Have you ever known somebody like that? Well, they don't mind asking questions. And then when you finally do give reasonable answers, it's like they really don't want that anyway. What they want is just to keep questioning. They feel safe in just keeping on asking the question. You're like, but I've answered that. Well, what about this? I just answered that. Well, what about this? Okay, that has been answered. Just because you don't like the answer doesn't mean it hasn't been answered, right? I think sometimes that's what happens. We pray to God, we don't get the answer we want. Paul didn't get the answer that he wanted in 2 Corinthians 12 about that thorn in the flesh. Three times God said, nope, my grace is sufficient. Paul doesn't go, well, I kept on asking. He stops because he says, if that's what it is, then I will have greater weakness, because in weakness God's glorified, and that's the way it should be. It's not the way of the world. The world wants what it wants. Well, we need to not be that way at all. Romans 8:28, talking about purpose, that's where Paul says most famously, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. The word, or the words, work together, comes from the Greek word that we get our word synergy from, where you take two different things that might be powerful and work in certain ways separately, but when they're put together, work in a much better way, more destructive way even. That's the word. All things work together for good, but not just anything and anyone, but for those who are called according to his purpose. I know there are a lot of religious people who think God chooses in some sort of a capricious way, sort of a random way, people to go to heaven, people go to hell. It's all on God. It's not on us at all. If we end up going to heaven, it's all on God. And if we end up going to hell, it's all on God. So we just live our life. Now, we might, in a huge umbrella way, say that they're all Calvinists. But not all Calvinists believe that. Not all people or Calvinists believe that. Not all people who believe that are Calvinists. I know, it's just one of those things. It's too easy to say it that way. But the idea of God's purpose, that God's purpose is elevated, it's not for those who are called according to his purpose and being the idea that the individual. It is God's purpose that supersedes everything. I think part of the problem with the Western mindset of things is we like the stories about the individual, right? We have, you know, the retelling of war stories. I like World War II war stories. I really do. It's just fascinating. My grandfather was in the Pacific Arena, so there's that. But the bottom line is, the way the stories were told in the 50s and 60s was about nations as they fought, developments that way. The way we tell the story now in the 20th and 21st centuries is about this one guy, you know, and how he survived the war. I'm thinking specifically of Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan. It's about one guy, really. I mean, yeah, there are other characters in there, but ultimately it's a story about a guy. We do that. We do this emphasis on the individual, and I don't know why we do that. I mean, I'm sure there's good reason to it, but that's not what Paul is speaking about here. Romans 8:28, he says, we know that for those. He doesn't say, I know that for me. He doesn't elevate an individual. He's elevating a group. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. That purpose, which reaches more than just a person. It's out for everybody, you know? Are we satisfied with God's ways? Well, if we are, then we're happy to do what he's telling us to do because we know it glorifies him. It's not about us. That's really the point I'm trying to get to. God's purposes and his ways are not about us. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verses 8 through 11, Paul is trying to emphasize, look what God's done. His designs are for our success ultimately. We belong to the day, he says. Let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has not destined us for wrath. I mean, that's not his purpose. That's not his desire. But to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us. When Paul speaks to the Corinthians about the death of Jesus, he's like, Jews are looking for signs, and the Greeks are looking after wisdom, but we offer Jesus, the Christ of God, crucified. To the Jews, this is a stumbling block. They don't get it. And to the Gentiles, it's foolishness that a God who is so great and powerful would come and die. What is that? Philosophically, it makes no sense. Be honest with you. If you really think about it, that which is greater, sacrificing itself at all, just is beyond full comprehension and appreciation. But this is exactly the gospel story. He died for us so that whether we are awake or whether we are asleep, that is, if we're living or dead, we might live with him. Therefore, encourage one another, build one another up just as you're doing. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, 13 to 14, again, that point is, we're bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through what? Sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth. Is that the way? Are we satisfied with this? Are we going to complain against God because he's not doing the way we would do it? Or grumble against him because life should be more fair or something like that? It's always interesting to me when people talk about how unfair things are in life. And I'm thinking, Jesus, the very Son of God, came to this world to a poor family. And it's not just that. It's not just poverty. It's just the fact that he didn't have much of a following. 1 Corinthians 15, we read, between the time that he was raised from the dead to the time of the day of Pentecost, 50 days, he had 500 brethren who showed up to see him, according to 1 Corinthians 15. In Book of Acts, the number is 120. I don't know, other than maybe he lost that many followers. May not be, I don't know. But it sounds like Paul is saying there were 500 eyewitnesses, and when the day of Pentecost came, less than 2 months later, there were only 120 who showed up. Can you imagine this man who changes really, truly the world? Just had 120 followers on the day of Pentecost. Would you have done it that way? I think I would have done it differently. Are we going to grumble against God? To which, that is, in truth, sanctification by the Spirit and truth, he called you by our gospel. He called you by what? A message. I do think this is part of the reason why there are religious people who think they have to have an experience. You know, what I was talking about earlier about the individual, there is so much of a point of emphasis on that. There are people who really truly believe they've got to have something special to them. God called me. I don't know about you, I really truly think if you read your Bible, when God approaches people, they don't go, "This is great, man. God called me, and look at what has changed for me." When they find out it's God, one, they are terrified, always. They never rejoice in this. They always are terrified by it. Moses, when he finds out the bush is burning, is like, "Oh, what?" And he's told to take his shoes off, right? I'd say Joshua's probably the only guy who the angel of the Lord comes to him and he pulls out his sword against him. He doesn't rejoice. He's like, "I'm ready for a fight," you know, that kind of thing. I've always found it interesting, people, "Oh, the Lord told me this. He talked out of all of the billions of people on the planet to me and told me something that he didn't tell anybody else." That's not the way he does things. Are we satisfied with that? Can we be? Yes. Are we satisfied with God? Is God's way of doing things enough for us? Is it sufficient? Are we content in him, in following his commands? 1 John 5:3, "This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome." There's nothing God gives us we can't do. And then Ephesians 5:8-10, "You were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth." Finding out what is acceptable to the Lord. Find out what pleases him. And like John is telling us, his commandments are not burdensome. This morning, we haven't talked about baptism and the importance of baptism as that which Jesus said to Nicodemus. "A man must be born again of water and spirit." There are a lot of people who argue with God or argue against God and say, "Well, you know, it's got to be this or that. I like it different. I want to be the exception to God's rule." Well, no. Ultimately, we got to do what he says because he is God and we are not. And he's not given a rule to you that he's not going to give to anybody else. Mankind has been given what God thinks through his word. Are we going to do that or not? And maybe you have done that, but you're not living the way you know you should. It's a matter of humility, really, humbleness to come to God and to answer, as we sing this song, "There's a stranger at the door," to answer the door, because he's not just some stranger. He's God himself who wants us to be with him. Come forward as we stand and sing.